From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet cinematographer Vilmos Zsigmond. He shot The Two Jakes, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and Deliverance. He came to Hollywood from Hungary, where he risked his life in 1956, smuggling out films of the short-lived revolution. Also, Was Not Was still is. The funk rock band has a new record. We'll talk to the band's co-founder, Don Was, who also produced Bonnie Raitt's comeback record, Nick of Time. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Motel, the latest installment in Public TV's POV series. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. At least five people were killed today when a tornado touched down in the northern Illinois town of Crest Hill. Police say dozens of people have been injured and many more may be trapped in the rubble. The twister flattened a 48-unit apartment complex and destroyed as many as 50 houses. Other tornadoes reportedly touched down in the nearby communities of Plainfield and Manhattan. The storms cut off power to thousands of area residents and caused a massive traffic pileup. President Bush briefed members of Congress today on U.S. strategy in the Persian Gulf. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The president interrupted his main vacation traveling to Washington from Kennebunkport for his first face-to-face contact with members of Congress since the Persian Gulf crisis began. The president briefed the top Democratic and Republican leaders at the White House, then met with more than 130 members of the Armed Services, Intelligence, and Foreign Affairs Committees of the House and Senate. The president said that his Persian Gulf policies were working and that reports indicated that traffic has finally stopped flowing through the Jordanian port of Aqaba, up until now one of the leakiest spots in the blockade. Members of Congress said that during the briefing, no criticisms were leveled at the president. So far, congressional and public support for the military buildup seems strong, but some lawmakers cautioned that if the U.S. involvement in the Gulf becomes protracted, or if there is loss of life, that support could wane. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
The Iraqi news agency said today that President Saddam Hussein has decided to release all the foreign women and children who've been detained in Iraq. Saddam's decree would permit the women and children to travel freely within Iraq or to leave the country, beginning tomorrow. The Pentagon announced today that Operation Desert Shield will cost twice as much as earlier projected. NPR's John Burnett reports.
The huge deployment of troops and equipment to the Arabian Peninsula will cost $2.5 billion, up from the original estimate of $1.2 billion. A Pentagon spokesman said the reasons for the higher cost of defending Saudi Arabia are primarily the soaring price of fuel, the 46,000 reserves and National Guard troops that are being called up, and the longer sailing times and flying times for cargo ships and planes. He said that some Persian Gulf countries, such as Saudi Arabia, have pledged to reimburse the United States for some of the cost of moving millions of tons of equipment to the region, but he could not give a specific figure. In other developments, the Pentagon announced that 170 ships have now been intercepted in the ongoing naval interdiction operation in Middle East waters. Fewer than 10 of those vessels have been actually boarded. The Pentagon spokesman said additional force has not been necessary since U.S. warships fired over the bows of two Iraqi oil tankers about a week and a half ago. I'm John Burnett in Washington.
Prices closed modestly higher today in cautious trading on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose just over 3 points to close at 2,614.85. Advances led declines by a margin of 4-3 in light trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The long-awaited sequel to Chinatown, The Two Jakes, has been neither a critical nor a commercial success, but it sure looks good. It was shot by my guest Vilmos Zsigmond. He won an Academy Award for cinematography for Close Encounters of the Third Kind. He also shot The Deer Hunter, The River, Deliverance, The Long Goodbye, Heaven's Gate, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and The Witches of Eastwick. Zsigmond and his friend and fellow cinematographer Laszlo Kovács left their native Hungary in 1956 after the Soviets crushed the Hungarian rebellion. The two young filmmakers risked their lives smuggling out footage of the revolution that briefly overthrew Soviet rule. Zsigmond's latest movie, The Two Jakes, was directed by its star, Jack Nicholson. The film's release was delayed several times, and once it opened, the reviews were generally bad. According to Vilmos Zsigmond, while they were shooting the film, they knew something was wrong.
There was always a problem with the script. I mean, I know that Jack was never happy with the script, and we started to shoot. But that was a problem between him and Robert Towne. At the beginning of the movie, I'm not sure. I mean, they are friends. I'm not sure if they are still friends now. I know that Jack complained always about that Robert Towne somehow was not helping him much with the script. He wanted to have a lot of changes, and he didn't get them from Robert. And Jack himself had to stay up many times at night, you know, to rewrite the script and to make it more comfortable for him. He always felt that the script was like a jigsaw puzzle, that the audiences might not understand everything, but they should understand. And when you look at the reviews, they all question the story. They all say that, you know, the picture is not understandable unless you see Chinatown. And this is a good thing for Chinatown because they will re-release it and people can see Chinatown again, maybe just to understand two Jakes.
What's the role of the cinematographer when there are feuds between the writer, the director, and the producer? Do you try to stay out of that?
You always stay out of it. Our department is really the set, the lighting, the compositions. And, you know, we help the director as much as he wants us to help. You know, Jack had a big job here because he had to write, he had to direct, he had to act. So when it came down to camera moves and camera setups, he was very happy that I took that job over for him.
There are probably a lot of decisions that you have to make before shooting even begins. Is one of those decisions what the palette of the movie will be? What colors will predominate in a movie?
Usually the style of the movie is decided together with the director and the cameraman, between the two of them, and occasionally the production designer gets involved also. So we basically, at the beginning, we had pretty good ideas regarding wide-angle lenses and a sort of dramatic approach to storytelling and telling the story from Jack's point of view, which means it's, Gittes' point of view. I think that's a good approach, and we decided that right away. So everything had to be dependent on that decision. And we added also the low angles, which meant that we had to build better sets with ceilings. Usually in Hollywood, don't like to build many ceilings because that's costly. But it's very interesting. I mean, Orson Welles did the Citizen Kane practically. In every single shot, you saw the ceiling, and that gives you a sort of reality for everything that happens. And realism was really what we were aiming for here. And besides that, we wanted to have a look which reminded you of the period. That's why the lighting had to be a sort of black and white lighting. I went back to the old style of lighting a little bit, you know, by using hard light, directional lights, backlights, cross lights. But basically, I always stayed in the style of the realism. Light is always coming from windows or from light sources.
When you're doing a movie, do you usually decide on a certain color scheme? Like which colors will predominate in a movie and what kind of mood those colors will give to the film?
Well, we wanted to have a sort of sepia tones in this movie. We thought that by using sepia tones, which is basically a mixture of yellow, orange, red, and browns, that has a certain desaturated look in color. It reminds you of black and white movies. Because if you look back at my old movies, McCabe and Mrs. Miller and Heaven's Gate and Cinderella Liberty, I always like to use warm tones in movies. This is basically, I think, because I admire Rembrandt and Caravaggio, and those paintings today have this kind of a look.
Well, let's go back to your film McCabe and Mrs. Miller from 1971. This is a film Robert Altman directed. There's a lot of browns in the movie. I think of the movie as being a kind of brown and gray.
Well, actually, what it is, actually, we had two different tones in that movie. We had the cold blue tones when it's raining outside and it's very dark early morning, or even in a winter day, you know, when the sun is behind the clouds, it has a sort of bluish look. So we had a lot of that in McCabe. But when we went inside, in those days they had kerosene lanterns and candles. So obviously we warmed up the interiors. So the mixture of this blue and orange or sepia tones gave you the look of McCabe and Mrs. Miller.
There's a lot of rain in this movie. This movie is about a bordello in the West. That's in part what it's about. And it's often raining in the film. Is rain hard to shoot?
It is hard to shoot, actually, because if you really want to show the rain, you have to backlight it. And of course, you know, we shot McCabe and Mrs. Miller in Vancouver in the wintertime, and it rained almost every day. So we didn't really have to use rain machines unless we really wanted to show that it's raining. You know, many times in the film you didn't see it was raining, but you felt the dampness, the humidity. And actually it was raining, but it didn't show on film.
One of the films that you shot, and this is the film you won the Academy Award for, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, had a lot of special effects in it. You know, mostly of the spaceships, and the spaceships were made up of lights, and it was visually stunning on screen. And in the family scenes, the colors are usually primary colors. There's a lot of reds and blues, the way I remember it. And in the otherworldly scenes, the colors change. Can you talk a little bit about what you did to get the different moods for, like, the family suburban scenes and the extraterrestrial scenes?
Well, basically, we were confronted here with the problem that how to show real life and how to show the other part, which I called it fantasy. The home scenes, we were very realistic about lighting it. We didn't use any blues or warm tones or anything. It was right in the middle, just to show real life. And I think the fantasy sequence basically also looked real, but it had a sort of science fiction reality that we set out to do something that if it would happen, this is the way it will look. So the concept of the spaceship being brightly lit, that was a concept from the very beginning, and we had to follow that up. In fact, you know, when they opened the door of that spaceship, there was so much light coming out that it blinded the eyes, and we wanted to create that effect. You know, when we actually shot the reverses of the people looking into the ship, I mean, you could see that tremendous amount of light, which I did by overexposing the film 3 or 4 stops. It was so overexposed that at one point Steven got frightened, and because we got some bad dailies which came back actually without showing any details of the people at all. And, you know, Steven said at that moment that, Vamos, you ruined me. And, of course, he was referring to that if you have to reshoot that scene, you know, it would cost $100,000. And I said, Steven, don't worry about it. It's going to print back to almost normal. And what we did, we ordered the reprint, and we found out that, yes, there were a lot of details there. It was bright, but it was right.
When you told him not to worry, were you panicking yourself?
No, not at all.
You really believed it was going to work?
Well, I made my test. I knew where I was, unless the laboratory did something to it, and which I cannot control sometimes. I knew that I was in a ballpark.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is cinematographer Vilmos Zsigmond. He won an Academy Award for his work with Close Encounters of the Third Kind and received Oscar nominations for The Deer Hunter and The River. He also shot McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Deliverance, The Long Goodbye, Heaven's Gate, The Witches of Eastwick, and The Two Jakes. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Cinematographer Vilmos Zsigmond is my guest. You grew up in Hungary. Some of the early film that you shot was actually film of what was going on around you. Tell us what you were shooting in Hungary at around 1956.
Well, I just finished film school in 1955, and I was a young cameraman, and they actually put me into the feature film studio, which I was very happy about because I always wanted to shoot feature films. Then the revolution happened in 1956, October, and I decided to leave Hungary. The reason I left, basically, was to go to Hollywood and learn and eventually go back to Hungary and use there what I learned. Of course, things didn't happen that way. The start in Hollywood was very, very difficult. It took me 10 years, actually, to get back to the position where I was in Hungary. After 10 years, things started to look good for me. I started to do documentaries at Wolper Productions. I did a lot of educational films, newsreels. And then I started to do low-budget features, which were not great pictures, but sometimes they show up after midnight on television screen with titles I already forgotten, actually. And sometimes they hound me because the story is so bad, the directing is so bad, and the photography is so-so.
Well, in 1956, when you left Hungary, you smuggled out some footage that you had shot in Hungary, footage of the revolution. What exactly did you shoot?
Well, we shot everything, actually. It was interesting. The first week when the revolution happened, we just lived the revolution. We were so overjoyed that we finally won. We won the revolution, and we wanted to have freedom away from the Russians. And after about 6 or 7 days, suddenly somebody said that, hey, guys, we should be shooting this. You know, I mean, how many times you have a revolution in a nation's life? So we realized that we were living so happily that we forgot about our profession. So that's when all the cameramen and directors went back and brought out the cameras from the studios and started to shoot what was happening everywhere, the joy of the people, and seeing, you know, how the farmers helped the revolution by bringing food to the people in Hungary, and seeing the Russian tanks, actually, with Hungarian flags, and the Russian soldiers fraternizing with the Hungarian soldiers and the Hungarian people. And we captured all that in this footage.
When you left in 1956, I thought you had to smuggle the footage out. Were you able to just carry it out, or did you have to hide it?
Well, after the Russians came in, after November 4th, and they occupied the studio, and we hid the film, actually, outside of the studio. And we had secret meetings among ourselves that what to do with the film. So we decided that we have to smuggle the film out. And since I already decided myself that I'm going to go to the West, I told them that I'm going to take it out. And that's when I ran into Laszlo Kovács, who also is a cameraman, and he was with me in the film school. And I asked him to join me because I felt that, you know, the two of us can do a better job than myself. And then a third person also joined us. So the three of us hid the film in a truck tire, inside of a truck tire. We had to break down the 1,000-foot loads into 300-foot loads to fit them into the tire. And we used that tire as a spare tire, and we wanted to head towards the border. And that's when that night they revoked all the licenses for the trucks and cars because so many people were escaping to the West. So we were stopped at that point, and we had to take the film out again of the tire, and we decided we'll put them into some potato sacks and we will carry it to the border that way. And that's what basically happened. 3 days later, we walked to the border to Austria. Of course, that was not that simple as it sounds now, because at one point we were captured by the Russian soldiers at the border. So we had to get rid of the film, and we saw them coming towards us, and We hid them in a corn stack. And we were hiding behind the corn stack ourselves. And the Russian soldiers were yelling at us, and they were firing in the air. And so we had to come away from behind the corn stacks. But we left the film inside. You know, needless to say, in those days, people were shot on the street if the Russians saw people taking still pictures. They were shot right on the spot. And we were scared to death.
But you ended up getting the film out of the country.
Well, they took us into a camp until night fell, and then we talked ourselves out of the camp by saying that we were living at the border and all that. And so they let us go, and in the middle of the night, we had to find that one corn stack in the whole field, you know, where we hid the film. And that was quite a challenge, I tell you that. It took us an hour to find that particular corn stack where the film was. But we finally did find it, and I remember we were running towards the border because we were afraid that another patrol is going to catch us.
So you risked your life to get this film across the border. Was it worth it? What happened to the film?
Well, it was worth it, actually, because I think it was tremendously important for us that the West is going to be able to see what the revolution looked like. Because, you know, there were so many lies, you know, the Russians said that it was a counter-revolution and minority of the people took the power and things like that. And our footage showed that it was a total revolution where 100% of the people were standing behind it. And there were only a few secret police AVO men who were shooting at us. And of course, you know, the footage showed how the Russians came in, how they destroyed Budapest in a couple of days. And that was all actually documented in this film.
Who did you give the film to so it could be seen?
Well, we sold actually the film to a German-Hungarian producer, Karpat Film, and they made a 2-hour documentary about Hungary from year 1000. And the most of the part, of course, was about the revolution. And then this company later on sold footage to CBS, and CBS had footage in a series, which was the 20th century series, and this segment was called Revolt in Hungary, and that was shown in the 5th anniversary of the Hungarian Revolution in 1961.
When you got started as a cinematographer in American movies, you started making a lot of horror films and exploitation movies, films like The Incredibly Strange Creatures Who Stopped Living and Became Crazy Mixed-Up Zombies, and Vampire Men of the Lost Planet, The Sadist, Mondo Mod. Were those movies a good way to break in?
Well, it was not really a good way to break in, but it was good for me because I practiced my profession. And all I did, actually, since I came to a different country where the movie-making style was totally different than in Hungary. I learned the basics in Hungary, but I never really learned to develop my own style. And these low-budget movies were great for me and Laszlo. We usually worked together on those movies that we developed a lighting style, which was basically being very simple, only light what was important, and be realistic. And that was already a good step in those days because Hollywood still was involved with an old style of movie making. They were still doing a lot of backlights, glamour lights, and unrealistic lighting, you know, and we hated that look. You know, we were actually brought up in Hungary in realism, and we watched all the Italian movies, all the neo-realistic movies like Bicycle Thief and Rome Open City. And we tried to follow that kind of a style of movie making. And luckily, there were some commercial companies in those days who were tired with the old style, and they were looking for something new, something more real. So that's why eventually these low budget pictures basically led us to the commercial field where we could we could actually use a different kind of a lighting.
Do you ever, in spite of what you're saying, do you ever wish to work with sets and back lots the way old Hollywood movies used to be shot, as opposed to working on location outside the way so many movies are shot today?
You know, strangely enough, actually, that in those days we hated studios because we thought that a realistic look only can be achieved on location, because the locations were dressed properly and you didn't have to add too much to it. And we could use the available light, which always looks realistic. And so we loved the location in those days. But today now, I like to work on the stage better. I think if you have a good production designer, he can build a set on the stage which looks much more real than any location set would look like. And the control, you have 100% control of daylight. Like, you know, you want a sunset scene, you don't have to shoot it in 5 minutes like in on a real location. You actually can maintain the sunset for days if you have to, and shoot that scene, you know, for 2 days.
Is there a scene in all of your movies that you're proudest of?
Well, I would say that from a certain point, you know, from the point I started to use my old name, which is Vilmos. I think if I had that name on the movie, I am proud of that. And my very early movies, those horror films and pornographic films and things like that, I had a different name. I used William. So whenever you see the name William, stay away from it.
Why did you change your name for those movies? Was it to hide your real identity or to just try to Americanize?
Well, they tried to Americanize me from the very beginning, you know, when you are new in this country and you have a hard time to speak English. And they are bothered, actually, that you have a name which is not easy to spell. And everybody told me that you have to change at least your first name so it will be more recognizable. So that's how they gave me the name William. And then when I did Peter Fonda's movie, The Hired Hand, Peter said, "You don't look William to me. I bet that was not your real name in Hungary." I said, "How did you know?" He said, "Well, I know things about, you know, Hungary." So he asked me what my name was, and I said it was Vilmos. He said, "What a beautiful name. I will put this on the title on this movie," he said.
And then you kept your name after that?
I kept my name after that.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your movies and your life. Thank you.
Thank you.
And my guest has been cinematographer Vilmos Zsigmond, and his new movie is The Two Jakes. He also shot Close Encounters of the Third Kind, The Deer Hunter, The River, Deliverance, The Witches of Eastwick, and McCabe and Mrs. Miller. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. You can tell a Was Not Was song by its funky beat and ironic lyrics. Coming up, we talk to the group's co-founder, Don Was. When he's not producing records for his own band, he's working with other performers like Bonnie Raitt, Iggy Pop, and the B-52s. In fact, Don Was produced Bonnie Raitt's album Nick of Time that swept the Grammys last winter. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the documentary Motel, about a few run-down or out-of-the-way motels inhabited by some eccentric characters. It's the latest film on Public TV's POV series. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. According to the official Iraqi news agency, President Saddam Hussein has said that all foreign women and children currently in Iraq are free to leave as of tomorrow. This sudden reversal of Iraqi policy comes after another TV visit with hostages. NPR's Ann Garrels has this report.
According to a government spokesman, President Saddam was deeply moved by his meeting, and the strong desire expressed by some of the women to leave influenced his decision. One woman, apparently from Britain, had asked Saddam why he was using children who do not understand what's going on as pawns. His repeated explanation that he was holding foreigners as a deterrent against war made little impression on the hostages. Saddam's decision to free women and children came later in the day. U.S. officials say they've received no official confirmation. The White House has reacted cautiously. And because it appears foreign men will still be held, a White House spokesman added, "Our position has always been that everyone should be allowed to leave." U.S. officials report that another 9 Americans have been rounded up, bringing the total number of Americans actually detained to 70. There are an estimated 2,500 Americans in Kuwait, another 500 in Baghdad. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
Dependents of U.S. Embassy personnel in Kuwait arrived this evening at Andrews Air Force Base outside of Washington. Luz Marina Cowell, wife of the U.S. consul in Kuwait, spoke for the group.
Our hearts are left in Kuwait and Baghdad with all our husbands, members of our family, our private American citizens, and members of the international community left behind.
The plane carried 20 women and 27 children. Officials in Morocco say Iraq is forcing its diplomats to evacuate their embassy in Kuwait. Peter Hyatt reports.
A long statement from the Moroccan government painted a picture of increasingly grim conditions for its diplomats in Kuwait, once Iraq's deadline for embassies there to close expired on Saturday. With food and money running out and worried about their families, the embassy staff eventually bowed to Iraqi threats and pressure and left for Baghdad. But once there, they were told they would not be allowed to leave Iraq because they'd lost their diplomatic immunity. The Moroccans say their staff are hostages, just like Westerners. Morocco has taken one of the strongest lines in the Arab world against the Iraqi invasion. It's one of only 3 Arab states to have sent troops to help defend Saudi Arabia. Now it seems it's paying the price for defying President Saddam Hussein. For National Public Radio, I'm Peter Hyatt reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 3 points. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. The band Was Not Was is back, setting irony to a dance beat. They have a new record, Are You Okay? The band was founded in 1980 by Don Fagenson and David Weiss, 2 white performers from Detroit who loved black music. They're now known as Don Was and David Was. Don writes the music, plays keyboards and bass, and David writes the lyrics, plays keyboards and flute, and does some of the vocals. Was Not Was had a 1988 novelty dance hit called Walk the Dinosaur. Since then, Don has become one of the most sought-after record producers. He produced Bonnie Raitt's record Nick of Time, which swept the Grammys, and he produced comeback records for the B-52s and Iggy Pop. New records by Bob Dylan and Elton John are on the way. One of the songs on the new Was Not Was record is an update of a 1972 Temptations hit.
Thank you. tears and I'm praying, wishing and hoping my dreams could come true, so I could feel like the other kids do. A young child, but not complete as a whole. Before I was born, you're up and strolled. Mama was there, but you was up in the wind. You never even knew my name, and then you never wrote, called, let alone came by. As a youth, it was hard to wonder why. But now I'm older, and I don't dwell in self-pity, thinking about the life you didn't give me. I remember when I used to tell lies. When people would ask, I just fantasized, making up stories to make you look good. But the real truth was, you was never no good. People used to say I look just like you, but rest assured, I don't act like you. I'm more than that. My mama raised me better, and you can best believe I'm much more together. So believe that.
Was it your choice to do this song?
It was suggested to us by our English record company person when we were touring there about 2 years ago. Said, you know, of all these bands over here, they play to DAT tapes or sequencers. Here you are, a real live soul band from Detroit, and you can play the songs live, and you have three singers who can, you know, give the Temptations a run for their money on these vocals. Why don't you go out there and flip people out? So it was kind of a frivolous encore we started performing, but clearly became the highlight of the show every night. There's some quality to the song. Well, it made us want to record it, but of course, there's already been a magnificent version of it, so we really had to try to think, well, you know, what can we lend new to this thing? And really, the only thing we could really naturally fall upon was that I think we felt that it was a little more serious song than it may have been portrayed as in the original, that the problem of the breakup of the family, and we didn't take such a benign view of the errant father, and I think the rap is a little more hard-hitting than the lyric of the original song.
You've often been in the position, I think, for many years of being a white person performing and arranging black-oriented music, black music.
That's true.
And I think part of what you're doing now is trying to still stay open to new black music, you know, and to black music being made by younger performers.
I'm trying to stay open to everything, to tell you the truth. Fact is that if you really, you know, flip around the radio dial here and listen to pop music, American black music is the American pop music. There's no, the black charts read very similarly to the pop charts in these days, so you really can't avoid it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd say I listen just as much to Hank Williams as I do Bobby Brown, so I don't know.
Mm-hmm. On your new record, in addition to like dance music and soul-oriented ballads, there's some novelty songs set to a dance beat. It's ever difficult for you to find a dance groove that will work with these obviously, well, a kind of very white, ironic lyric?
It comes pretty naturally, which hopefully is, you know, the charm of the band, I think, that that the two can be so neatly juxtaposed. And a lot of credit, the beat is not as hard to come up with, I think, as the honest interpretation that the singers give it. And yet these guys give these soul-wrenching performances to lyrics that have no precedent for it, really. I think that's their great strength.
Were they always comfortable doing that?
No, it was quite the opposite. Our singer, Sweet Pea Atkinson, actually walked out of the first session where we gave him a lyric like Little Michael on a motorcycle with leather pants and a leather brain. He ain't never been the same since Vietnam. He said, leather brain? I ain't singing this, and he's out the door. And he just didn't, you know, he didn't get it, didn't mean anything to him. And frankly, I couldn't stop him. He walked out the door, got in his car, and left. And we brought in our second singer, Sir Harry Bowens, at that juncture. And at that point, a great rivalry was born. But inbred into this rivalry between the singers is to never turn down material when offered. But I think now it's the challenge of the... they. I think they'd feel let down if we didn't bring them, you know, obscure lyrics to sing. Although every now and then, I believe in the dark of the night, they long for a nice, as Sweepy puts it, a nice bedroom song to deliver.
Did you write them any for the new record?
Not ours, no. I think love is mentioned in there someplace on the album.
David was, your partner, once referred to you as the Alan Lomax of the dance clubs, and he said that you used to take a tape recorder with you to the dance clubs to try to record the beat and take it home and tinker with it?
Yeah, well, I noticed when we first started doing these 12-inch remixes back in the early 80s, the idea, which at the time was fresh, as opposed to what a 12-inch mix was in 1980, was the album version of the song with like maybe an instrumental verse and chorus edited into it, and, you know, nothing really happened. So we started thinking, well, what if you like adapted some of the principles of Jamaican dub music and really changed the song around dramatically for the purpose of keeping people dancing in clubs? And in experimenting with this, we found that sitting in the studio, things that would freak us out and we'd think, oh, people go crazy when that happens, they would be irrelevant when you were actually in a club and dancing. So I thought, all right, I'm going to go to the clubs, I'm going to stand there and dance, and when I hear something that's really affecting me, I'm going to tape it and try to figure out what's going on with this. So, yeah, we were disco anthropologists. So.
Well, let me get back to the Kmart wardrobe. Do you think that dancers would be comfortable dancing to a lyric about Kmart clothing?
History has proven that they're not comfortable dancing. a great lesson came. We had a number one dance record in 1982 with a song called Tell Me That I'm Dreaming, which was a very wild, impressionistic verbal barrage. And it, instead of putting a saxophone solo in the song, we used Ronald Reagan's voice saying, "Can we who man the ship of state deny that it's out of control?" And in the 12-inch mix, we just kept trailing off, out of control, out of control. And dancers missed the Reagan point, missed any kind of political connotation, and just thought, yeah, I'm dancing out of control, give me more acid or whatever. And so we learned that people aren't there to, it's not a cerebral experience going to a club. It's as legitimate, mind you, but it just, those, you know, it's a new set of criteria.
Dunn Was is my guest, co-founder of the band Was Not Was. He's also one of the most sought-after record producers today. And after we take a short break, we'll talk about producing Bonnie Raitt's comeback record, Nick of Time. This is Fresh Air. Dunn Was is my guest. I interviewed you a couple of years ago when your previous album, What Up Dog, came out. And you'd casually mentioned that you were producing a Bonnie Raitt album.
Right.
And little did I know that this is going to be, you know, album of the year.
Don't feel bad. Nobody knows.
Yeah, right. I guess I'm really wondering what approach you took to producing that really made such a big difference in Bonnie Raitt's career, and I think in yours as well. I think she's someone who'd probably been a victim of producers for a long time, people thinking, okay, I'm really going to make you sound contemporary.
Well, I'll tell you the truth. I sort of had that feeling myself, but after working with her, I don't think she'd stand for being the victim of anybody. I think she made records she wanted to make, you know, whether records were, you know, successful or not. I think she wanted to stretch. This happened to be the moment when it was appropriate to stretch back to square one.
Mm-hmm.
I just felt personally that I was very influenced by her very first album, which was recorded in a barn someplace on a little four-track or an eight-track, and, you know, it's not really a great recording, but you can just sense the spirit of all the people playing together and that it's a fun album, and just the feel is paramount on this record. And we really just tried to keep reminding ourselves of that, keep it sparse, come up with good songs, get great vocal performances, and don't let things get in the way of Bonnie. Let's have an intimate encounter with Bonnie right here.
You have a studio in your home, right?
Right, yeah.
Is that where you record, or do you use that more as a place to make sketches of records?
Yeah, I would say it's more for sketching. Although, you know, in the case it wasn't, I was often the sketches are the... I mean, that's originally why we set it up, was because we spent too much time trying to recreate our sketches to no avail. You know, I mean, there's something about the initial moment of inspiration that you're not going to recreate by hiring some session guys to go in there and play it. So, yeah, it's my little workshop, yeah.
So how would you use that if you're producing a record?
If I was producing for somebody else?
Yeah.
I don't use it that often. I mean, I use it, it's mainly an economic thing. You know, in the case of, for example, in the case of Bonnie Raitt's album, when we first hooked up, she had no record deal. And even when she did have a record deal, the expectations for sales were not really great. And we had to make the album on a very low budget, which is, I think, one of the things that helped keep us in line in terms of making a sparse direct album. What wasn't, I was had an experience in the early 80s where a record company told us to get rid of our singers and get some young, good-looking white kids to front the band. And when we wouldn't do it, they cut off our funds for making an album. They said, you get no more money till you comply with our wishes. So it was more of a survivalist technique, I think, in the beginning. I mean, certainly, you know, no one can stop me from working anymore, which is what happened to me for a couple of years then.
How did you produce Bonnie Raitt's record? I mean, how were you chosen to produce it?
We met on a record that was put together by a guy named Hal Wilner, who's a tribute to Walt Disney, with various artists performing songs. And we'd worked with him before. He's done some really wonderful records, a tribute to Thelonious Monk and...
Kurt Vile.
Kurt Vile, yeah, okay. So... I had an idea. Because of our participation in the Monk album, where everyone, you know, it's a great, all artists want to be part of these records because it gives you total freedom. So everyone who has to conform to making hit records goes totally left field on this thing. And I think we got lost in left field someplace. So anticipating this on the next one, I said, all right, I'm going to take a Disney song and make it really normal and palatable. And in this fashion, it'll stand out on the album. And I came up with an arrangement for a song called Baby Mine from Dumbo. And once I had the arrangement, I heard Bonnie Raitt's voice in my head.
Baby mine, don't you cry. Baby mine, dry your eyes. Rest your head close to my heart, never to part. Baby of mine, little one, when you play, don't you mind what they say? Let those eyes sparkle and shine, never.
You and your partner David Was have a cameo in the movie The Freshman.
Right, that's right.
And you're backing up Burt Parks he's performing at a very shishy party.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you know this, but but Burt Parks is going to be emceeing Miss America again because I think I have the story. I guess the producers of the pageant saw the movie and thought that his parody, the parody that he sings of the Miss America song, was so clever.
Good. Well,
you learn this by watching the morning TV talk shows. You know?
That's good. All right, I missed that. That's well, good for him. You know, I could just tell the way he talked about it 10 years after the fact that it was a. You know, it was not a nice thing that happened to him. And I'm glad this wrong has been corrected. He's a terrific guy, Burt Parks. Very intelligent, very funny. We had a wonderful time working with him. And I think he did a hell of a job on Maggie's Farm, as did Bob Dylan, by the way. Who I think that's actually how David and I ended up with the gig of working with Bob, is that we sent him a copy of Burt's version of Maggie's Farm.
And that's how... That's how you ended up producing Dylan?
That's actually how we met him. We met him in Toronto while we were working on the film. And I think he was willing to see us because he'd heard the Maggie's Farm version that we sent to him.
That's like a really silly way to end up producing a Bob Dylan record. Through Bird Parks.
Yeah.
Okay.
Who'd have thought?
Huh? Yeah, really. So are you going to keep the Don Was name? What's your real name? Fagerson, is that it?
Faginson. Yeah.
Faginson, yeah. Are you going to keep calling yourself Don Was now that you have a dual identity?
Well, yeah, I'm kind of stuck with it. I mean, I never legally changed my name, but people sort of know me as that. People should be forewarned. You know, if you're going to choose a pseudonym, choose one you really like, because you know, you have to register in hotels. You don't want to. You know, this name is wide open for wisecracks. In fact, you can take a shot if you want, Terry. Go ahead, make a joke about it.
Well, I'll tell you, has been. You made one of the good jokes already. I read that you were going to do a record called Was Not Was, Has Beens. I really love that. I think that would be very funny. I think you should do it sometime. Sometime when you can think it's very funny.
Exactly. Sometimes when it's not so close to the truth.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Always a pleasure, Terry.
Composer, musician, and record producer Don Was. Here's How the Heart Behaves from the new Was Not Was record, Are You Okay? This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what stories from the Persian Gulf?
Well, the President of the United States left his vacation home in Maine today to come to Washington to brief members of Congress on what he is doing in the Persian Gulf. And Saddam Hussein, the President of Iraq, was on television again today, Terry, showing pictures of hostages, visiting with hostages, and he issued a challenge to the President of the United States and to the Prime Minister of Great Britain to debate him, to talk with him, and even to debate him on television on the issues involved in the Middle East. And five young people have been found horribly murdered in Gainesville, Florida, just as university classes are starting.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This week, the public TV documentary series POV features Motel. It's filmmaker Christian Blackwood's record of some off-the-beaten-path motels and the people who stay there and work there. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
When I was a little kid, 5, 6, 7 years old, my parents and sister and I would pile in a car and make our annual vacation odyssey from Pittsburgh to Fort Lauderdale. Each time, we stayed in motor inns or motels. And at that age, it seemed like a big deal and a big treat. So I came to this documentary, Motel, expecting a warm look that would spark memories from 30 years ago. Instead, what I got was a geek show and a freak show that makes me wonder whether Blackwood, the director, was enjoying the people he found or exploiting them. I guess he treats them well enough, but I haven't seen this many weird real people gathered in one documentary since Errol Morris visited and made a film called Vernon, Florida. At one motel in Santa Fe, there's a lady named Helen who looks just like Nadine, the lady with the eye patch on Twin Peaks, and acts like her, too. For Blackwood's camera, she and her coworkers describe and gleefully reenact the time their motel was robbed.
And I see this young man with a little gun, and I said, hey, what do you think you're doing, young punk? And I walked around, and I kind of touched him, you know, and I said, hey, you think you can steal our money? And I grabbed his front shirt like this. He threw me overboard. I fall down. I see him take a box. And I get up. And I grab him by his legs. And he fall out of the door.
Come to think of it, almost every character in Motel seems to be based on a character from TV or the movies. There's a woman in love with a man less than half her age who brings to mind Harold and Maude. There's another woman staying at a motel in Arizona whose story is uncannily similar to the love story told in the movie Raising Arizona.
How did you actually meet Bill?
When I was a guard in that unit.
In what unit?
In the minimum custody unit. And I was what they called the operations officer in that unit. And he was one of the inmates in that unit.
He's a lifer.
Yes, he is a lifer. He's doing 25 to life.
For what?
For murder, first degree murder.
Finally, there's a man, a prison inmate who escaped to a motel across from the local prison, whose story seems straight from a horror movie. Which one? A pleasant little film called I Dismember Mama.
We, at that time, were also advised that a lieutenant from the prison had been contacted by Mr. Mormon and asked to come to the motel room to pick up some dog bones to give to the dogs at the prison. From that, we asked to retrieve that box so that we could examine them. It turned out to be Mrs. Mormon's lower extremities. She had taken her here into the bathroom and with a serrated steak knife and a buck knife had completely dismantled her body.
There's no denying that Motel is a fascinating documentary, but it's also kind of creepy. As a matter of fact, I'm just about to pack up my own family for a driving tour that will take me, once again, from Pennsylvania to Florida. But now, I think, we'll try to travel nonstop.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with help from Joan Tui and Roberta Shurrock. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the composer who sets David Lynch's images to music. A talk with Angelo Badalamenti about writing the music for Twin Peaks, Blue Velvet, and Wild at Heart. And rock historian Ed Ward remembers Wanda Jackson, a singer Ed says rivaled Elvis for sexiness. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.